I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi, Gina.
Hi, Ioni. Hi, everyone. I'm Gina, the senior editor of Polyester.
And I'm Ioni, the founding editor-in-chief of Polyester, and this is the Polyester Podcast, a feminist pop culture podcast dissecting the discourse on a weekly basis.
Before we start, if you're a fan of this podcast, please make sure to like, rate, and subscribe. And if you really love us, you can sign up for a podcast membership, where you can join our Discord and get on our Instagram close friends for only about £3 a month. Today is an extra special episode.
Woo, 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 woo.
Bang, 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 bang.
We did an event last week at the Barbican. Podcast members were invited, as were all of our members. So you should join, side note anyway. it was for their Resistors exhibition, which is a lens on gender and ecology. We had three amazing panellists, which will introduce themselves, Rini, Diora, and Zara, who was moderating the discussion. Zara, some listeners may recognise from our Art Rookie column. And yeah, we're not there, but maybe you want a break. Well, we were there, but we're not on the recording. Maybe you will appreciate a break from our voices.
And Misha does a surprise cameo as well.
Yeah. So here it is.
Welcome to the Polyester Podcast, IRL. I'm a little ill, so this is what I'm going to sound like. And I think it's kind of chic, so we're going to go with
that. Sounds sexy, actually.
Thank you. I'm kind of putting it on as well, but you know. So welcome to the exhibition, like welcome to our talk. My name is Zara. I'm an art historian, kind of. I'm finishing my dissertation now, so hopefully soon. I'm a journalist. I write about modern and contemporary art and its intersections with gender, social capital, etc. I'm so excited and honored to discuss the show with the artist Rini Matic and journalist Diora. And I'm sorry, I can't pronounce your last name.
Diora Shadjanova.
That. Beautiful name. And before we start, I think Misha is going to just say something for us.
Hello, I'm Misha. I'm the culture editor for Polyester, and I'm going to be reading a statement from the Barbican about the show that you've all just been to, because it's very beautiful and we love it. Featuring around 50 international women and gender non-conforming artists, Resistors, A Lens on Gender and Ecology is a new exhibition featuring work from emerging and established artists across photography and film. Works in the exhibition explore women's understanding of our environment, and it has often resisted the logic of capitalist economies, which places the exploitation of the planet at its center. They're presented alongside works of an activist nature that show how women and other marginalized communities are regularly at the forefront of advocating and caring for the planet. The show is split into six sections that explore a range of themes. The first, in extractive economies / exploding ecologies, artists explore how to photographically represent extractive economies and the detrimental effects industrial extraction has on communities around the world. Two, the second section, Mutation, takes its name from François Debon's 1974 book Feminism or Death, in which the author seeks out a new, less masculine term for revolution, opting for the organic change that mutation suggests. Here, the exhibition presents documentation of women-led resistance movements from the historic struggles of the 1970s and 80s, such as the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, the Seneca Women's Encampment for a Future of Peace and Justice, and the Chipko movement in the Himalayas, to contemporary protests, such as the local resistance movement against the Flint water crisis in Michigan, USA. 3. The next chapter is entitled Earth Maintenance and explores the relationship between the undervalued work of domestic care, historically performed by women, and the similarly undervalued work of ecological stewardship. Among other artists, Miela Lademan-Ukeles and Helene Eilon exhibit documentation of performance artworks that attempt to make the visible and the necessary reproductive labor performed in both the public and private sphere. 4. In the first two bays upstairs, Performing Ground seeks to trace a counter-history to representations of the land and the body in post-1960s art history, with women photographers undoing the distinction between human and more than human, seeking communion with, instead of domination of, our natural environment. In doing so, these artists explore how representations of women's body and the land have always been acts entangled in history, power, and agency. 5. In the penultimate section, the artists exhibiting all consider the interrelated power dynamics of capitalist land ownership and colonialism. As the name suggests, Reclaiming the Commons foregrounds the left of the land from public ownership, arguing alongside feminists like Silvia Federici that reinstating the commons is crucial for collective emancipation. 6. The last chapter, Liquid Bodies, looks to contemporary artists that are using water as a heuristic to think through a non-binary approach to both gender and the divisions between humans and the natural world. Nadia Huggins' striking self-portraits depict her becoming one with the coral life that contribute to the oceanic biomes of her Caribbean home, while colonial, mythic and queer histories of water are addressed in Josefa Nitijam's installation that considers black being in the afterlives of Atlantic slavery. Ultimately, Resistors acknowledges that women and other oppressed communities are at the center of the battleground against the extractive logics of capitalism and the concomitant structure of patriarchy, not only as victims of dispossession, but also as comrades, as protagonists of the resistance. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Misha. So, yeah, I was going to do a little survey of the show myself, but no, we don't have to do that anymore. The show is so extensive, and I think it covers so much that, like, it spans temporalities and geographies. So I feel like it's going to be, like, quite difficult to kind of, like, talk about everything. I've made the personal decision to, like, kind of talk more about, like, the gender and ecology aspect of it, like, how it both, like, interlinks, as well as, like radical care and labor and how that kind of manifests. Is that cool?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah. But before we start, do you want to introduce yourselves and what you do and how, like, the themes of the show manifest in your practice or reflect in your practice? Rini, do you want to start?
Yeah. So my name's Rini Matic. I'm an artist and writer. I guess, like, my work spans across, like, photography and film predominantly, which is probably why I was asked to come on here. Where is Ione? Oh my God. I was trying to, like, side-eye her, like, what? That's why she's in the back, because I can't side-eye her this whole time. But yeah, so I think that in the ways in which my work, I mean, like, I'm trying to figure this out myself, right? Like, I've seen the show twice, and I think really I'm interested in this idea of care, and, like, we were just saying, this kind of desperation to keep something alive. That's really something that I think is really prominent in my work and telling stories. And I use lots of different things. I use the body a lot, and dance and movement and language, but really it is kind of this archival desperation to love and to care for a thing, and yet, like, want it to be held forever. And I think that's how it kind of intersects with this show, because of, yeah, what we were just saying a little bit about, like, I don't know, this urge to want something to be saved and figuring out how to save it. I think that my practice is like a slight figuring out of how to save a thing, be it me or my friends or, like, the love that we share for each other in the queer community. yeah, but this is, I have to say, like, I'm not the most eco slay queen. That's why you're here. So I'm really excited. Yeah, no pressure. I'm excited for this conversation because, yeah, looking at the show is honestly the first time that I felt like, oh, okay, I see myself in this as well, which is also interesting.
Yeah, well, thanks for that introduction. I've also seen the show twice. I think I had to come back. I don't know if anyone else gets this. When I get into an exhibition, I get so excited and I spend so long looking at like the first five things, and then I get really hungry and then I'm like, oh no. And then I try and like look at more art, but, like, nothing's going in. So I actually had to leave and then come back another day. But yeah, so my name is Diorosha Dejanova and I use she, they pronouns. I'm a journalist, first and foremost, but also a writer. I also organise the Hot House Book Club, which is a really lovely book club I organise with my friend Izzy, who might be in this audience, I don't know. And yeah, so it's really nice. We've been meeting like every 6 weeks with friends and reading new books on climate change. And sometimes it's depressing. And I'd also, you know, when introducing myself, I'd say like I've been doing a lot of observation in the last year. Like, yeah, I've traveled in Uzbekistan. I spent 5 months there this year, and it really opened my eyes into how my work relates to climate change and relates to what's happening already in a lot of countries in the global south. I am from Uzbekistan, and I moved to the UK when I was 10, so I haven't been back there in 20 years, and it was quite like a big shock to see how, yeah, like people's material realities and, you know, just things like some of my family members don't have water for half the day because the water's just dried up because it's been so hot, and unseasonably so. So it's just like things like that that really, really bring my work into reality. And I guess, yeah, this exhibition was so exciting for me to come to because a lot of my work is centered in climate justice. And when I'm thinking of climate justice, I'm not looking at it as just, you know, temperatures rising or, you know, CO2 concentrations getting higher in the atmosphere. I'm looking at all the ways other social justice issues intersect with it and kind of looking at the same root cause. Yeah, I think it was just really exciting. I've also got an art history background. I don't actually remember anything from my degree because I like specialise in medieval architecture. But yeah, it's just really nice to engage with art in a meaningful way. And yeah, like Rini, I felt like a lot of the things I'm thinking about were explored in this exhibition, and I'm super excited to talk about them.
Yeah, thank you so much. So you've both been to the show twice. I've only been once myself, which is bad. Now I feel like I should go back. But I kind of want to start off with like what your first initial like visceral reactions or responses to the show was. Like, what did you feel when you entered the space? What kind? I also want to ask, and this is something I don't think people ask enough, what did you anticipate going in? Because you probably had a little bit of understanding what the show was going to be, and how did the show kind of like deviate from that or like surprise you and challenge your preconceived notions? Either of you can start.
Yeah, I think, like, to be honest, like, I just never expected to enjoy it because I do think, like, there's... I often find that there's... I feel, yeah, a lot of the time outside of conversations like this, and I do find that a lot of artists that are more well-known, that work with the environment and such, are of maybe a more privileged background than myself. So I kind of am a bit like, I was a bit eye-rolly. I was like, okay, what's this then? Great title, though. I was like, oh my God, imagine the meeting that they had when they came up with that title.
Jumping for everyone.
Like, yeah, literally. Yeah, I was like, oh my God, someone got a promotion from having that title. but so, yeah, originally I was a bit like, what? Which actually I'm quite a lot like that in most exhibitions anyway. I want to be surprised. I'm just a bit like, oh yeah, what are you going to show me then? What? I know everything already, you know, which definitely isn't the case and definitely wasn't the case in this. But then when I slowed myself down, which I did today, I was like, okay, you know, like I said before, like I am in this actually and should be actually. And like, I think that maybe there's something that goes on in the reason as to why someone like me, who's like a working class black queer person, would think that actually like, that isn't a space that I am, like a dialogue or a narrative that I am welcome in, you know? I think that there's obviously something going on there, which I'm sure you'll tell me about.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lack of intersectionality in like a lot of climate spaces, absolutely. But yeah, it's interesting what you say about the title. It took me like a while to figure it out. I was like, Re-sisters. And when I got home, I was like, oh my God, it's resistors. And
mic drop.
Yeah, I got it a little bit later on. But I think for me, yeah, I didn't really know what to anticipate because I feel like in my line of work, I've done quite a lot of reporting on how gender-based violence and sexism is kind of related to the climate crisis. And we can talk about that a little bit more in detail later. But so I knew that there is, you know, like an actual link there, but I didn't know what to expect. And I think the main takeaway for me was this idea of sort of removing that binary between the people and nature. And I think that was really, really prominent in this exhibition and kind of going away with the idea that, you know, people are nature, we are nature. And it brings me to this quote that's been kind of swirling around my head for the last couple of months. I read Tori Choi's book, It's Not Just You, which is, focuses on mental health and the climate crisis. And she writes in the book, we are nature defending itself. And I think that's such an interesting quote. And when I look at a lot of this art, I think this is, you know, the resistance, the art that's being created that resists the climate crisis is, you know, nature too, right? So, and I think you, when you come into the exhibition, you know, you see the We Won't Play Nature to Your Culture piece by Barbara Kruger. And I think it's this refusal to see the world through binaries and dualisms that seek to subjugate and control, and historically they have done. And it poses a question of why these dualisms exist in the first place. So I just wanted to touch on some of the art that I felt like really kind of captured that for me. So I really loved Fina Morales's work, where she covers herself in straw, you know, the photographer.
Is it that?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Actually, yeah, the art on your screens. And yeah, I just really loved this idea of like, you know, immersion in the straw, and it reminded me of like, you know, that feeling you get when you immerse yourself in water. Or one time, a few times I've swum in the Dead Sea because my family used to live in Jordan, and you can, you know, cover yourself in mud. And I don't know, it's just really liberating to be part of that wider whole. And I don't know, it makes me like think about abandoning individualism, and the act of, you know, like covering yourself in straw is kind of weird in the most wonderful way. And even for the duration of that performance, like, I don't know, it's nice to sort of go against society's role for you. And for a lot of people, that relates to gender. And I was also thinking about Laura Aguilar's nature self-portraits. So I think Laura is a queer, large-bodied, working-class Chicana woman who there's these wonderful photos of her body in like the I think it's the Southwest in America, where she poses as like a rock or a tree. Mm. And, you know, at first I was like, wow, like what an incredible statement, you know, to make, as it's asking questions about who belongs in this space and who belongs in these lands that have been kind of, you know, divided up and ruled over. But also on second viewing, I was like, this is actually incredibly queer and joyful. And it reminded me of that scene in Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, when the protagonist turns into a rock. And I just, like, I remember seeing the film and thinking, I really want to be a rock sometimes. Like, I wish I could just abandon like all the shackles of what it is to exist in my body and actually just like be, you know, like a rock. And yeah, and I just really, really relate it to that work. And I loved, yeah, all the work that kind of made me think about how, you know, we are part of that wider nature and part of that organic organism.
That's so interesting you said that with the rock, because there's this Weeze Blood lyric that I always think about, which is like, God, please turn me into a flower, which I just feel like I really think about all the time, like this idea of like I want to know what it feels like to not be human, like what the other species feel like. And I also think what you were saying about us trying to, I think it was you, about us trying to remember that we're not separate from nature. We're part of it. We're part of like the ecology. We're not separate. We're not like looking at it from a distance, that we're all part of it. And we have to kind of play our part in protecting it, preserving it. And like, we do need to, like, I think a huge thing that the exhibition left on me as well, like a huge imprint, was this idea of like, we're all like in this together, and that's how we're gonna, like, collective care is how we're gonna get through, or like at least help, you know, the fight against the climate crisis. And what you were saying, Rini, as well, like, ecofeminism initially was disbanded because it was so essentialist and it kind of ignored the problems of Indigenous people or people of colour. And now it's great to see that a huge institution like the Barbican is reappropriating that term in a beautiful way to incorporate indigeneity, to incorporate, like, people of colour from different, like, and talk about colonialism and settler colonialism in a very, like, deep and powerful way. Did you have anything to add to that, either of you?
Well, I think, because I didn't say what I, like, took away from the exhibition, I guess, is this idea of, like, what is really killing us, you know, and, like, the different ways in which we are, I guess, like, I don't know, there was a work, I don't know who the artist was, the film work with, like, the installation, like, the chairs and, like, bits and bobs going on, gorgeous, go and see it. there was a moment in that film where they're talking about, you know, the death rates of Black people in, I think, you know, it was about the US, and how we obviously look towards police violence a lot, but we never talk about how, like, the larger scale reasons as to why Black people are dying and people of colour are dying is because of things that come from the environment. And I feel like a bit stupid for being like, oh shit, yeah, like, fuck, obviously. But that for me was a big wake up call in terms of how the collective understanding of what is actually, like, what we are surviving essentially is all just one big ecosystem, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I think, going back to ecofeminism, it's actually not really a term that I've ever used for myself. Not that I don't agree with the values of ecofeminism in my work, I do. But I think it's, as I mentioned before, I think I just see climate justice as the same fight, you know, for feminism and against gender-based violence. And I think, you know, talking about things like racism and colonialism and all the different societal issues that exist today, for me, the climate crisis is kind of this umbrella issue that not only exacerbates all these socio-political issues, you know, such as human rights issues and land rights issues, but they're also, you know, they all have the same root cause, which is capitalism. And, you know, and I think when we think about how is the climate crisis related to gender issues, and it's because, well, patriarchy is also like a very foundational tool of capitalism. And yeah, and I think just like when you can see in the exhibition, you can see like all the art that's showing the extraction and the expansion and the theft and the violence that's needed to sustain capitalism, because ultimately this limitless growth that, you know, feeds this system and for it to work is unsustainable on a planet with finite resources. And yeah, and I think just exploring these parallels of the patriarchy and the use of and having power over women, or having power over people that have been deemed, you know, beneath those who have power, and then also looking at kind of like the wider scale of the climate crisis, and the same issues are repeated when you're looking at having power over Indigenous people and having power over resources. And essentially it's just all about, like, the way we need to fix this is for it all to be equal and for it all to be equitable and for it all to be shared. And I think when, you know, obviously this is boiling it down, but I think when you just look at the issue straight in the face, you can see how all these issues are related.
For sure. Another theme I really want to touch on is like how bodies were used throughout the exhibition. So of course, like with the Chipko movement, where the women's were kind of like protecting the tree.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
He's like very overtly by like covering them up to like basically protect them from being like chopped off. Or in Maggie Murray's photographs of the anti-nuclear war movement, I think, where they were putting themselves in front of like police cars, etc. Or even like in Anna Mendieta's artworks, where she uses her body. Why? And I know, like, Rini, you used the body a lot in your work. I remember from, I think it was last year, at South London Gallery, I saw the picture of, I think it was your back, where it was like born British, die British, and how you reappropriate. I don't know if that's the right word, or we use this like far right saying or slogan to kind of talk about your own Britishness and your blackness and how that kind of interplays. So I just want to talk about this idea of like, why do you think bodies, and more specifically women and non-binary people's bodies, are used politically, and what does that provoke really when you talk about that in like a radical sense? I don't know if that...
Yeah, I mean, this is something like, especially as someone who images the body, that I have to keep like checking myself on, you know, and making sure that, because we can't escape the gaze in which that is looking, that I'm doing the best job I possibly can at getting the message across, or at least just like paying attention to who's looking and making sure that the audience is also aware that I know that they're looking at me as well. And I think that that's one of the most powerful things about looking, about using the body, because there is this relational element to it. So I think that perhaps in terms of this exhibition, like the works that have the body in it, or that have something that like looks like something that an audience member would recognize, is a really important like immediate like draw to attention. It makes it personal, you know, and I think that that's something that is really important in terms of this exhibition, especially for me looking. But I think that it's spooky using the body, because you're just like, this is the site of so much violence and so much oppression, and you can't escape that. And I think that a lot of work using the body is actually an attempt at escaping that. But whether we can do that or not is not really up to us. You know, whether we can emancipate ourselves from being looked at in the ways in which we don't want to be looked at. I don't know if that's possible, but yeah, like this work I find really interesting because it's kind of about this like invisibility, or like wanting to remove the body from the image, or like, I guess, go undetected almost as well. And I think that what you were saying about coming into nature, immersing oneself in water or mud or whatever, there's an element of being undetected and therefore not being surveilled.
And not being perceived.
Not being perceived, yeah. And in a culture of mass surveillance, maybe that's a way in which we can work. I don't know, now I'm like, it's weird because I guess saying we can work with nature like suggests that I'm separating the human from that, you know. So actually the language that we use about it is really interesting. But if I was going to say that, yeah, I guess like us working together with nature, maybe there's more possibilities for being outside of capitalism than we think, especially in terms of being surveyed.
Yeah, I just wanted to come in. I found what you said really interesting about the body kind of being like almost, I actually don't know what you... A site of...
Yeah, violence.
Yeah, and I actually was also thinking about land being
exactly.
a site
yeah.
of violence and theft and, you know, exploitation yeah. and extraction. And I think you really see that and the vastness of that in Simran Gill's Eyes and Storm series. Like, as you come into the exhibition, you see those really, like, big photographs of, like, bird's eye view and the, I guess, the scars that mining has left on the land and how we've shaped this land. And sometimes it can be really hard to imagine the scale of the climate crisis, but when you see it in such a stark way, you think, wow, like, we really have shaped these lands. And I'm thinking a lot at the moment about, like, land as a witness and like as a storyteller as well. And I think land is always there to tell us a story. It's telling a story like on a continuum. Our job is to connect with it and hear its story. But there are obviously so many things that are in the way of us having that relationship, having that connection, having that conversation with land. And yeah, and I liked that Simran's work was called Eyes and Storms because it's kind of like, you know, it's like an ever watching eye of like, you know, the land, if you were to, you know, kind of personify it, it's there and it's seeing this, it's witnessing what's happening to it. And you can't ever really hide that fact.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Okay, so let's just talk about this idea of like, okay, let me try to combine both really quickly. So this idea of like, this radical politics of care is something that really permeated this idea that everyone who presented their work at the show like deeply wanted to like immerse themselves in nature, didn't see a binary between them and the like the natural world, so to speak. So I guess to like end off our discussion, what do you think people should take away from the show? Something maybe actionable, something that, you know, like obviously like in a gallery space it's easy to like see it and then think of it as like separate from our world, but with a show like this it's really important to think deeper about it and kind of like let it permeate into our lives and the things we do and the actions we take. So is there like anything, maybe a piece that really stuck with you think we should think about deeper, that when we go back to the show we can think about, or anything of the sort?
Well, I think from what we just said about recognizing the similarities between the site in which we inhabit, you know, being bodies or land, recognizing that everything, you know, is connected and we are connected to the things that are all around us. I don't know, in my work, I think, like I said in the beginning, this urgency, like I think that that's the thing with anyone talking about fighting for something, is you just want to grab hold of someone and make them see, you know,
shake them.
Yeah, I want to shake them and have that like come on, like have this passion and this like, you know, understanding of how deep something is. And I think that there's different elements in this show that are attempting to do that, you know. But, you know, I don't know to take away from the show. I would say I just think what you said before, basically, about like being one in the same, you know, and just like, and I don't know, I'm a bit shit at this because I'm just like, I just went to see the show again. So it takes a while to like understand. And I think because I was coming on the panel, I was like, whoa, actually, maybe I'm considering some things that I didn't consider before, you know. But yeah, I don't know, it's a good show.
Yeah, I'm like really glad I got to like do this as well, because it kind of forced me to think about the show in a deeper way. And
yeah.
I'm like you, I don't really think about the climate crisis really, yeah. because that's bad and that's yeah. on me, but I don't. Not part of my like what yeah. I'm interested in academically or professionally.
Yeah.
But it really did get me to like think about things that I wouldn't have thought about before.
I think it's the emotional level, yeah. isn't it? But it's mostly like it feels a bit gross to say, oh, you need to liken it to something that you can sympathize and empathize with in order to care. That's kind of a shit, you know, thing.
But that's how we're like programmed, unfortunately.
Exactly.
Like the way systems of knowledge work and the way we were taught in school at uni. Like, it's just...
Yeah, it's just a bit gross. I think that's what I'm thinking about. I'm like, oh my God, no,
wow. You have to, like, reprogram it.
Yeah, I feel a bit like, whoa. I don't know.
Do you have any?
Well, yeah, I mean, this, you know, coming to Sex Vision is a great way to start deprogramming and, like, linking all these injustices together. And I think I just want to quickly, you know, make a point about care and then talk about what I would say to take away or what I took away. So, yeah, with care, it's very obvious that, you know, we need collective care. And care, yeah, has to come in the form of collective care and not individualized form of self-care that we're now being sold everywhere. And I recently read this book by The Care Collective. It's a tiny little orange book called The Care Manifesto, which I really recommend. And they say in there that neoliberal capitalism is uncaring by design. And I really kind of like this idea that it's not this, like, accident, right? And they talk about the four features of caring communities, which are mutual support, public space, shared resources, and local democracy. And one piece that I really, really liked from this exhibition, actually, was the... I'm going to butcher this name. I think it's Merle Laderman Ukelis. The Touch Sanitization Project, where the artist basically goes around and shakes over 8,500 New York sanitation employees. Shakes their hands, sorry. She doesn't shake them. She shakes their hands.
What did you think about that?
Yeah, I thought it was, firstly, like, a really, really great piece of art. And it sort of made me think about, you know, contrary to how it likes to present itself, you know, think vast, kind of glass, gated, grey and extremely clean, you know, talking about capitalism, contrary to how it likes to present itself within architecture and urban design and, you know, sort of like very manicured, right? When I think about capitalism, I think like Girl Boss, I think The Wing, I think, you know, just like Glossier, just like very, very, sorry. I use Glossier. Sorry, if there's any representatives in here. No, but like just basically just like really polished and you know, but in reality, like this economic system leaves behind a lot of waste. And the question is, who has to clean that waste and why? And a lot of the time, it is marginalized people. It is often women of color. It's often people who are invisibilized in society and often are undocumented. And, you know, and think of how much waste you see each day in cities, in the seas, in natural landscapes you think are remote enough to, like, not even have waste in them. But, you know, you'll see, like, a crisp packet or something like that, or a vape. So, yeah, I want to say Francois Verges is a fantastic writer who writes about waste, race, and gender and capitalism in A Decolonial Feminism. And she uses the terms cleaning and care interchangeably. And she argues that without the work of marginalized people, who are often invisible, neoliberal and patriarchal capitalism wouldn't really. And yeah, and I think what I would take away from this exhibition, if there is one thing to take away, and I think there's so many, is just, you know, if all it is today that, like, you go into the exhibition and just something links, right? Like, one issue that you didn't think was linked to another links, like, that's the whole... That's wonderful, that's great. And I feel like in the work that I've been doing as a climate journalist, and I've realised that this issue does unite all these other issues I've cared about. And it's not like, oh, I'm just going to put all my time into this, like, one specific issue or this other specific issue. Sorry, I forgot about the microphone. It is about just seeing all of this work as part of that collective work, part of that collective care. And just, yeah, if you see things within a collective, it becomes a lot easier and a lot less, you know, weight on your shoulders.
Perfect. I think we have time for some questions from the audience now. If anyone has one, Misha, I'll probably, like, give you a mic.
Hi, my name's Safini, and I actually had a question kind of directed at all of you, but it's like an open question, so don't worry if you don't have like a direct answer. But do you think that, like, the view of, like, general people in society that, like, there has to be dichotomies or there has to be dualities between people and nature is like a, like, kind of like a root cause of why there's so much destruction and extraction? Because if generally people just see themselves as people and are separate to nature, then, like, in so many areas of just consumerism or just day-to-day life, do you think that's just, like, a root cause of a lot of these problems that we're seeing?
Sure. Yeah, I thanks for that question. I feel like how I approach it, and this is definitely not necessarily the correct answer, but I definitely see categorization as a tool of oppression, right? Those oppressions can be different, but definitely when it comes to categorizing and creating binaries and creating, A or B, like I think that can be extremely harmful, but I see it more as like a tool of oppression, so not necessarily a source. That's what I would say.
Yeah, for sure. I also feel like what you were saying about like the way knowledge is produced, the way like economies were constructed, it all kind of was directed towards like this idea of like profit, or I don't know, like labor, that's the labor that's like taking care of your house, taking care of like the people around you, that kind of labor isn't, and taking care of nature in this context, that kind of labor isn't monetized and profitable. So that's the kind of labor that we shouldn't like indulge in, because that's a waste, quote unquote. And I think, I don't know if that answers the question, but that's kind of how like capitalism and colonialism, like that's kind of the bedrock of it, at least a very simplified understanding of it. And also that's one of the reasons why like when, you know, like what's happening in the world right now with like settler violence, it's, they don't really care about the resources, because for them it's all about profitability, and it kind of destroys land, it destroys natural resources. So yeah, just, yeah, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
I don't think this works. Oh, it does. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think that essentially we are recognizing the error of our ways. And that's what this is, right? Yeah. That's what these conversations are, like recognizing how much damage we have done in all aspects of life, basically, and trying to undo it as much as we can. But that does mean that certain people and certain privileges can get away with, I guess, not really caring that much, because things don't affect them as much as they affect other people. So yeah, it's like a slow kind of process. I don't know. I definitely feel it in my own family, you know, like people who lived through the 60s and then very much enjoyed plastic, you know, and love plastic and what it did. And like, it's just really interesting to see how, even though it's like, I don't know, it's just happened really fucking fast, I guess, but how we're sitting on this stage as people who have profited from that, but are like eager to not sustain the issues.
Yeah, I just like, I want to add to that and just say that I think it's really important to ask about like what the root cause of these issues is. And I think I'm definitely not an expert on this, but Emma Dabiri writes about this in What White People Should Do Next. And she touches about the essentially like the birth of racism and colonialism, and how that was birthed by capitalism and by the need to extract and expand and accumulate wealth in, you know, the kind of imperial core, or obviously there were different empires, but yeah, and that categorization of people, that divide and rule, came about as a way to control people from getting together and being like, hang on a minute, like we're being treated really fucking badly here, let's just unite against this one common enemy and yeah, have collective power. And that use of categorization was very much used to create the racial code, to basically divide working class people who wanted to fight against oppression. So I think like just looking there is like a great start, is what I would say.
Thank you so much. Anyone else?
Hello.
I
have a question more of like the kind of gender side. I was kind of thinking as you were talking about how historically women and non-binary people have often have been associated with nature in a really negative sense, whether that's women being sort of reduced to their nature, or people who identify as non-binary being told that they are somehow against what's natural. And I just sort of wondered if you could speak to how the exhibition maybe kind of resists that idea, or pushes against this kind of negative association of women and non-binary people with nature, and how it can actually force us to see nature as something that isn't fixed and that is maybe more ephemeral or essentially non-binary, if that's a bit of an oxymoron, but yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think that you know, I talk a lot about this limitlessness. You mentioned limitlessness as well, but you were mostly referring to like capitalism and how it like grows and grows and grows. But actually, you know, nature does as well, as do we. And I think that in terms of, yeah, this exhibition, it just kind of makes that a fact, you know? It's like, this is the truth. We are not fixed, and we do continue to grow in many different ways. And actually, to be fixed is to really reduce something and stop it from going. And that is so counterintuitive. In terms of definitions, like you were saying about, you know, Emma's work is incredible in terms of that. But yeah, I think that myself as a non-binary person and as a mixed race person as well, like, I talk a lot about this idea that of feeling stuck almost, you know, or like, actually, no, that's a lie. I don't feel stuck because I'm not, but I am told to remain in my place a lot of the time. And I think that there's a lot of work. I mean, literally all of the work in this exhibition goes against that, right? Because it's being told, it's about saying, it's almost about like unearthing a truth or many truths. And I think that that's what being non-binary is. It isn't a fixed third gender, it is the multiple truths. And I think that every work in this exhibition does a job for, I don't know, making that obvious, that lots of different things can exist in lots of different times, and we can all exist in this timeline together and on multiple timelines too.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I think, like, I've been thinking a lot about my own, you know, relationship to gender and kind of wanting to exist beyond the binary, but also thinking about, you know, we're told at school that, like, you know, when you learn about the animal kingdom and, you know, oh, like, there are lions and they're alphas, and then there is, like, I don't know what the women are called, but not the alphas. And essentially that binary is presented, like, all the way throughout, like, what we have learned about the natural world. But I think once you realize that we as humans have projected those binaries onto the natural world, and actually the natural world is a lot more queer than it has been presented for such a long time, and in educational space as well. And there's a great collective who, by the way, look into this. And I think they're called the Queer Ecology Institute, which I really would recommend checking out their work. They do fab work. But yeah, and I think, I actually don't remember where I was going with this, but just been thinking a lot about the fact that nature's queer.
I think that that's interesting, though, because you spoke, like, that's as like, we have assumed that nature's, it has a voice for sure, but we have, like, a very Western, like, colonial, we've given it that voice, you know, and that's what we have then assumed that role of, and that's just not true.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm sure there are so many different, like, cultures around the world who have not viewed nature in that way as well, and have not positioned themselves as above, like, other animals or other species in our environment, for sure.
Perfect. One more question. Do we have time? No. Okay. Sorry, we don't have time. But thank you all for coming again. Thank you so much, Rini and Diora.
Thank you.
Had such a lovely chat.
Thank you.
That was good.
Yeah, it's such a good conversation. I thought it really, like, engaged me in ways I wasn't expecting. Like, I think what Rini said about, like, you go into an exhibition sometimes thinking, like, you already know everything about a topic, and then it's really exciting when going into it changes your mind. And that's kind of, like, how I felt about the podcast episode as well. Like, listening to their conversation definitely put, like, new ideas in my head, not just about the exhibition itself, but about how ecology relates to feminism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same. So thank you to all of the panelists and to the Barbican for having us. It was very fun. And thank you to Olivia for editing this episode. We will be back next week, as per usual.
Yes, thank you all so much. I think the exhibition's running until the 14th of January, so make sure you head down and go have a look at it.
Go have a little look-see.
Bye!
Bye!
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.